Before John arrived, I plagued Dennis and John Phillips by asking them what they wanted me to ask them, what prompts they wanted, and they refused to play. They refused to give me any help at all. However, I thought of something in the middle of all this excellent exchange about Sassoon's love of paradox, sightless seeing, and so on. And I remembered a quotation from Chesterton, which I'm doing off the top of my head, so forgive me if it's slightly wrong. But Chesterton said some systems of thought were like a classical temple, perfectly proportioned, with graceful arches supporting an exactly calculated canopy. But that the Church of Rome was more like a huge, rugged and romantic rock, I'm sure I'm remembering that bit right, where each projection and rough bit perfectly balanced another bit, so that it looked as though the thing would fall over at any moment, but it never did. Mm. After that rather lengthy introduction, can I ask you three what you think about Siegfried Sassoon and paradox, especially as regards his faith? What a question to drop on them unprepared.
I think it'd be worse if we had prepared. You know, excuse. You're the expert.
Was the paradox part of the appeal?
No, I don't think it was for me. I think it was just the beauty of his writing, really, rather than the paradox. No, that wasn't.
But do you think the paradox was what appealed to him?
Possibly, yes.
I think Siegfried was always much more in love with the sound of words than with ideas. He said that time and time again. But I think it's the very sound of the paradoxes which attracted him. And that was more important to him. And he says so in his one sort of extramural lecture, that it was the sound of words that meant more to him in poetry than anything.
When did he give that lecture and where?
He gave it at Bristol University, just before the Second War.
Yes, it's published, isn't
it? It's published.
In Bristol University, I think so.
I've got a copy of it.
I would like to say that significantly, Sassoon was enamoured of two poets, Gerard Manley Hopkins and Dylan Thomas. He's very supportive and complimentary about Dylan Thomas, and both of them, of course, are about the sound of words. It is this music within words. But I would like to emphasise that I do not quite accept the degree to which it's sometimes projected that Sassoon wasn't interested in intellectual ideas. I think that was a bit of a thing on his part there. You know, the way he played himself down.
Yeah.
I think he was a hugely intelligent person. Mm. So well read. But I think underlying it all was just the thrill of poetry. It was the sort of music to him. And of course, he would be trained in the classical as he was. Not that he was a great classicist, but he was trained in the classical languages and traditions. Music is within that language, isn't it? In Greek and so on, it's part of the magical. So I would say that the paradox, the music appealed to him, but I also think that Sassoon, I use the word cheeky, but I think Sassoon saw double things. He saw things that were not, that were opposites from each other, you know? And that appeals to me enormously, because I don't think, in a way, life isn't black and white, even though he said I've got authority carry me through now on a guide, but there's something about paradox that reflects the fact that we live in a world that is not necessarily black and white, but something, a mixture of the two very often.
Going back to the sound of words, he was very fond of alliteration too.
Mm.
It abounds in his poetry, more than in the poetry of anyone else that I know of.
Well, that's why I like Dylan Thomas.
Mm.
Thomas is an artist in alliteration, so is Jerry Manley Hopkins.
Yeah.
They love the click, the sound of the click, you know.
Yes.
But I wouldn't want people to think that really is there's something deeper in Sassoon, I think, intellectually and spiritually deeper than just the sound of the...
Oh, yes,
you know,
that must be so.
Yeah, I think so.
Isn't this a function of his experience of life? I mean, he's had this extraordinary life, going from the trenches to this contemplative old age. I mean, after all, Owen did survive the war. he only ended up in a mental hospital for the last 15 years of his life.
Mm.
But Sisson has lived through all of that, and his poetry must surely contain all these extraordinary contradictory experiences and things, mustn't they?
Mm.
So that actually there's a kind of paradoxical element that we draw, in a way, a kind of critical reflection of that.
Yes. His life is a paradox.
Well, I mean, his life is comprehended all the I don't know how many other players have actually lived through that kind of experience into these later experiences.
Mm.
I mean, it's almost impossible to simply have done that.
Mm.
Is there any other war player who has any comparable sort of issue? I don't think so. I think the First World War probably contained the totality of their existence.
Well, Blunden. Blunden, of course. Edmund Blunden.
Yes.
But neither Graves nor Blunden actually used this alliteration to the same degree as Sassoon.
I think Sassoon believed, and his exact phrase was, in direct utterance.
Yes,
and
sure.
He was very critical of many modern poets who wrapped the ideas up so tightly that not everyone, in fact a great many people, can't understand a word they're saying.
But is it one thing, James, you say that one of the things about Sassoon also is that when you say direct utterance, but he didn't always use direct words because he had this awful tendency. I mean, he'd use orison rather than prayer. I mean, nobody used orison. I mean, I had to rush to tell him what it was. You know, he quite enjoyed finding odd words, but he also enjoyed putting un in front of everything. You know, he sort of not unbodiment or some bodiment. I mean, he was kind of strange terms, didn't he?
Yes.
For someone who said direct utterance. It isn't always direct utterance.
But I mean, the whole of the corpus of the war poems is direct utterance. Oh, Jesus, send me a wound today and I'll believe in your bread and wine and get my bloody old sins washed white.
Yes. Yes.
I mean, that is what he meant by direct
utterance. Yes, I see. Right.
May I have a question to do with Alzheimer's? Which is a question that I asked on the Sanskrit, which didn't or was an answer. And this was, do you think that the monastic life appealed to Sassoon in any way? And if not, why not?
I'm surprised Dr. Sebastian didn't answer that one. Dr. Philip would like to have a go at this.
I don't think it did. It never really struck me that he wanted to be a monk. He liked being with monks, so that there seems to be no question in his old age anyway. But I don't think he ever met a monk until quite late on in his life, as far as I know.
Mm.
And I certainly didn't know him, and never, gosh, the amount of knowledge that you people have got, the way you've read him, and I haven't. I just knew him, really, and some of his poems, but not many. I'm going to have to go back and start doing some more serious research into his poetry.
But he was known as the hermit. Okay,
he was.
Course,
a hermit
I think he implies
I've got that on
but
one
he
of
didn't
his
like it. I don't think he liked it, did he?
Well, no,
being called
he
the hermit.
Felt sorry for himself when he talked about being the hermit.
Yes, exactly.
He loved the company of people, but he loved his own company.
Yes, yes.
He loved monks, but he didn't want to be one.
No. Well, of course, could I say something else to you? Because we were talking about this earlier. In Lenten Illumination, it starts off by not really Catholic, not proper. You know, I want to be on my own in this white chapel. I think the fact that I don't think Sassoon could actually, because one of the demands of a place like Downside, I think I write this, is that you have to be part of the community, part of the community, that you don't live on your own or to yourself, you live in a community.
Yes.
So in a way, I don't think Sassoon could live in community. I would,
oh no.
Would you say?
Absolutely right.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So I would say he's not. No, he wouldn't have been a monk.
Silent, and everything I read about Sassoon says he could never stop talking and went on forever. So I think sort of vows of silence could
But the thing is, that's interesting, because he wrote about stillness and silence, but he didn't practice it.
Yeah,
yeah, quite right. That's another paradox. Yeah.
When he was being instructed, I wish Sebastian was here, he would come pretty regularly, once a week. Apart from that, not as often as that, no. He'd come and play cricket during the summer and get a boy to run for him, whilst he did sort of nice cuts and pushes. But to use a technical term,
yes.
would drive up in this extraordinary car which had a dickey at the back and swerve about and not look where he was going as he was driving along. It was a fairly horrendous experience to be driven by Siegfried.
Nightmare.
Yes, you could call it that.
Yes.
You should have blurred eyes and not try and see what's coming.
Yes.
It's probably the better thing to do. He would come pretty frequently, yes, until almost the end of his life. And we would go over there to him, particularly Aylred Watkin, who was a great friend of the Asquiths at Mells, as he was, as Siegfried was. And Sebastian, who had this great literary background. You don't get a first class at Cambridge in English literature for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And his knowledge, which continues to this day, of reading and recommending books. How he ever gets anything in the way of sleep, I don't know, because he produces about at least an A4 sheet every day of screed on this, that, or the other, and constantly keeps us up to the mark on what we've read and haven't read.
Mm.
How he does it, I just don't know. Perhaps he doesn't ever sleep.
I think he actually...
I forgot to mention earlier when we had the film on about Sebastian that he's got a book coming out later this year to mark his 90th birthday. And apparently this book has come about because he writes a lot of things down, his ideas on different subjects, and gives them out to people.
Yes.
And unknowing to him, someone has been collecting these for several years and has put them together into a book which is coming out in December to mark his 90th birthday. I forgot to mention that earlier on.
Do you know who's publishing it?
Dennis has something to say about this.
I think one must always remember with Siegfried that he never got up before 12 o'clock.
Mm.
And as he lived through the morning, reading, writing endless letters as he lay in bed, must be a lovely thing to be able to do.
Mm.
And you can recharge your batteries very easily if you don't get up till 12 o'clock. And particularly as he always had a rest before supper, too. And used to breathe deep sighs about, I'm so exhausted. I got a wonderful tape of Siegfried. I had brought this machine to Heytesbury and tried to get him to read some poems for me into it. And he kept on saying, yes, we'll come round to that tomorrow.
Mm.
And I'd given up all hope. And he, on the last evening, he said, fetch me your infernal machine.
Mm.
And he read about 18 poems onto it.
Mm.
And the nice thing was, it was wonderfully unprofessional.
Mm.
You could hear him knocking out his pipe as he read.
Yeah.
And there were these deep sighs. audible on the tape, just as his voice was.
Yes.
Dennis, you mentioned, didn't you, in your radio programme, these deep sighs, particularly when he was talking about the war.
Yeah.
Don Philip, did he ever talk about his war experiences to you?
No. And I didn't press him
no.
on that. Because my father went through the same war, and I thought it was marvellous for him.
Mm.
Longed to know more about Gallipoli. No.
No.
He wouldn't touch it. And so I never pressed Siegfried on that. Some of it comes out elsewhere, but not to me. And I didn't feel it was fair, really.
No.
It was such an unspeakably awful thing that they had to go through.
Equally, Siegfried, up to the middle 50s, was suffering from nightmares about the war.
Mm-hmm.
And if I ever served a purpose in his life, it was to be the idiot boy listening to what he had to say. I was absolutely fascinated by his account of the war, and he poured it out and said eventually that he had not been getting nightmares.
Oh.
Right,
I think
right.
he needed to unload that war on someone.
I think he describes it, doesn't he, as the world's worst wound.
Yes.
Mm.
And talking about direct speech, that's it, isn't it?
Yes.
The world's worst wound.
Mm.
And he didn't want to read
alliteration.
Go on.
As
yes,
well.
Again, yes. He didn't want to go on picking the wound, did he? Right. Mm. He also, didn't he, am I right in saying that really in the winter months between sort of September to Easter, he wouldn't really venture much out of Heytesbury?
No.
That it was the spring and the summer he'd come out. Mm. And he'd do his writing in the winter.
Yes.
Really.
And feel very lonely.
Yes,
too.
Absolutely. Yes.
Why doesn't X and Y come to see me,
yes.
he'd say. And then in the course of a conversation you'd find that Philip had been to lunch the
yes,
day before,
yes.
Ian Balding had come
yes.
to talk about horses to
yes.
him.
Yes.
And
yes.
That's right.
It was extraordinary.
That's right. And then he would write to Felicitas and so on and say, nobody comes to see me.
Yes,
yes.
You know.
Yes.
I love that. Another paradox. Perversity.
Yes, you
Well, he talked obviously a lot about Owen,
mm.
a great deal about Owen, and often said, what would he have been had he lived?
Mm.
The thing that astonished me about his talk of the war was the way in which he remembered all the names
yes.
mm. of the people. Not just his intimate friends,
mm.
but he could have told you the Christian names of all his platoon.
Yes.
He was encyclopedic about that.
Mm.
He had a wonderful memory. And he could tell you the date on which he went into the line and the date on which he came out of the line. Extraordinary.
Mm.
Do we have any other questions?
Could I just ask, my knowledge is very shallow. Do you feel that he was a lonely man?
He would say that, but I don't think he was. I think he had a lot of friends, and they rallied round a great deal, not only from this community, of whom there were several, but also others as well. And he had a literary status, and that got him to London and to other people in that way. So I don't think he was lonely. I think that people did rally around him a lot. And because he complained of loneliness and of living in this miserable hermitage, this great big house in Heytesbury.
Mm.
But I don't think he wanted to live anywhere else. Because
mm.
one of the things that I remember about him was that if he quoted a poet or a writing, an author, he would then go straight to where it was
yes,
on the shelves
brilliant.
And pick it off the shelves without a moment's hesitation where it was. And he had a lot of books in that house.
I think something even more remarkable was that he could actually tell you where to go and get the book. And in a way, it was easy for him to go and get the book. And he could
yes.
say,
yes.
you know, go down the corridor, turn right, left,
yes.
and so forth, one along and so on. I remember that remarkable.
He never did that with me.
Yeah. Miss Galsworthy, whom I met, she's living in Warminster. And she was quite remarkable about him. He told her to go and get the evidence of the king, And she said, I didn't know where to look, because all it was like the Bodleian Library.
Yes.
And he said, I don't know where it is. And he said, you've got, you turn left, you go down this part, then you see a green book and a blue book there, and it's a fourth and last from there. And she just went and she picked it up. I mean, that's amazing.
Yes.
Really.
Yes. Yeah.
On this business of loneliness, I think almost my favourite of all his poems is not the one he calls Alone,
no.
But the one which is actually about being alone.
No. Yes.
Mm. When I'm alone, the word
yes.
Stripped off his tongue is
alone.
Be alone, nothing
strange. To him.
When I was young, he said.
Yes.
When I was young, and on in that vein. Mm.
But is that the same, Dennis? You would say the poem Alone. That is, that's not the same as loneliness.
No, it isn't.
That's
and you're absolutely
that's
right.
That's the point. Yeah.
It's an investigation of the word alone,
yes.
Where all but inmost
but
space
yes.
is
overturned. Yes, yes. Mm. And he says we have to learn to be alone.
Yes.
So he's actually instructed us to be alone.
Yes.
It's part of your spiritual discipline.
And it's a part of recharging the battery.
Yes. And part of growing silent and being still. I mean, all those things are in there. Simply because he didn't mind being alone. But this element, whether he was lonely, I think he must have been, but all of us are lonely.
Yes.
At times, aren't we? I mean, you can't go through the kind of experiences. I mean, part of the thing that I feel about Sassoon is this, that, two points. About the war, I think the reason why the resurrection is so much in his poetry is because he saw so much death. I mean, we don't know how they handled grief. They didn't know how to handle grief after the war. And it was a major thing, you know, because you were seeing them dying like flies, you know. As A. Hausman said, if they die like flies, they die like flies. So there were people who were almost indifferent to it, some poets. Whereas Sassoon, because his work had come out of it, and he was very... And I would say, I mean, this is going to be... You can't quote this. But in a way, it appealed very much to something in Sassoon. It sort of was a very feminine person, sort of a feminine quality in the care that he had for these people. There was almost a maternal feeling for them. You know, we need to understand that about him, I think. But he saw so much death with others, so much death. People very near to him, as well as people who were not near, that somehow, even though one death is as much as a thousand, nonetheless, it was on such a scale.
Yeah.
You know, I never go through this country, you know, I don't go through this now, but when I travel to Scotland, I'm amazed. Every village has got this huge memorial.
When you think about it, I mean, even with the Iraq War, we're told an individual soldier died yesterday.
Yeah.
On the 1st of July, between breakfast and
sunset,
59,754
yes.
men were killed, wounded, or
yes.
missing.
Yes.
I.
No, it's not comparable.
We need reminding of that
yes. Yes.
all the time.
Yes.
May I have a question? I'm interested in the motivation for the conversion. I should know from having read the biographies, but in the, shall we say, the 2 decades prior to the conversion, what happened to him in his religious life? Was he practicing a member of the Church of England?
No. Did he have any
friends with whom he could share religious discussions,
no.
as he did here?
No.
Or was it in fact a very fallow period which almost made him
ripe
for conversion?
I'd have thought the last. Yes. But I don't know. Again, I never pried into that with him.
Mm.
And he, with me, was not going to talk about it. So I can't really tell you.
He'd met Catherine Asquith again, hadn't he, in the early 1950s?
Yes.
Yes.
Which might have been a preliminary.
Yes. And Ronnie Knox.
Mm.
I always feel that he was potentially a deeply religious person,
yes, yes.
searching for
yes,
something he
yes.
could believe in.
Mm.
And I can remember him saying, I just want to be told what to do.
Yes, authority. Mm. One clear guide, you know. We've got the light there.
And in the beginning of the major conversion,
yes.
And what were you doing, going into churches all the
time? Yes, exactly.
Of faith unfaithful.
Yes, yes.
And the Church of England was not providing that for him. So
No.
But you see his significance. Sorry, you can see this significance of soon to the day is what Dennis has just said. He was looking for something, he didn't know what it was. There was a vacuum in his life. And this is, in a way, what his poetry is about. He's searching for something to fill the vacuum. And he went down, so I'll have lentil illuminations, that there were many byways down which he went. He says, many byways, many altars, the shrines of illusions, that they led nowhere. I gave them all up. Gradually, it was being... The mystics, you know, they say about that, in a way, the mood of your conversion is that God is stripping you down,
yes,
till you're absolutely down to nothing.
Yes.
It's called, that's what the cloud of unknowing is about. You're being stripped down until there is nothing but that.
I think it was very, very important that he met the Catholics that he did meet.
Oh, yes, yes.
I mean, the downside monks, he adored them.
Yeah.
And the Asquith family, and Ron, above all, I think, probably Mother Margaret.
Yes.
But Ronnie Knox, what a wonderful mind.
Yes.
What an understanding person.
Mm.
He was someone who could give Siegfried exactly what he was looking for.
I wonder if I could throw a little pebble in the water here and ask Dennis and Philip a question, because I'm not of your persuasion, but I'm of your convictions. Is this that... There is an accusation laid against Siegfried that he was a snob. And, no, it is, the people say he was a snob. And part of it is that his attraction was that he wasn't really attracted to, let us say, the Irish Catholics, but to rather illustrious beings and very well connected beings, and many of them converts to the church rather than cradle. Now, I know you've taken a vow of poverty. You're a wonderful person. But can you forgive me for asking such pertinent questions?
That's all right. Yes, it never occurred to me that he was a snob, but perhaps he didn't have any use for common folk.
No.
Yes. That just simply hadn't occurred.
The word they use today is not snob, but elitist. They use the vernacular for snob.
Yes.
I never thought of Siegfried as a snob, and I think it's just worth remembering that his opening bat partner in the Heytesbury team was a shepherd off Salisbury Plain, Sam Dredge.
Mm.
And Sam Dredge meant a great deal to him, and he constantly was praising him and delighted when every spring Sam was pictured in the local paper with a newborn lamb under each arm.
Yeah.
He wasn't a snob.
No, but you heard the accusation.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
One hears
I just
it all
wanted,
the time.
But I was going to put it in the religious context. Really, I'm talking about. Was he attracted to pretty exclusive, you know, downside and Stanbrook and so on? I mean,
well,
he was
dedicated to people who had active minds.
Yes.
And knowledge that he liked to hear about.
Yes, yes. So what are you saying, there's a paradox that he was sort of intolerant of someone who wasn't intellectually yet?
Well, no, we get back to the alone bit.
Mm.
He liked to take a long time thinking about things.
Yes.
And you can do that best when you're on your own.
Yes.
I don't think he... It never struck me as being a snob.
No.
He was a bit of an aesthetic snob, perhaps it was that, was it? In Lenten Illuminations, he says, in one version, it's why in those Anglican churches could they find no home, his longings. And then he changes it in another version to why in those hallowed minsters could they find no home. Now, that might have been to avoid giving offence to Anglicans, I don't know, but it also strikes me that part of him must have been very drawn to the beautiful ancient buildings, which by and large belong to the Church of England.
But it doesn't make you a snob.
No,
well, it might make you an aesthetic. Well, an aesthetic elitist, perhaps.
Oh, well done. Oh, I think that's very good.
Superior, or perhaps I mean, an instigative attitude towards all of the things he was going to restore could do to me, set against the bad things perhaps that he felt to Jen. So I reached him as a person quite self-effacing. I don't read him as a person particularly humble in his heart. What do you think about that?
He was very self-aware,
mm.
Which was a self-regarding thing, which is vain. I think he was that. He knew which was his best profile. It took me a long time to discover that my right profile is the one.
Lucky you, I haven't got a profile at all.
I think he was very much aware of his image. Yes, that is true. That is, I suppose, a weakness in people. Though I can think of a good many.
Could I add to that? One of the things that struck me as I read correspondence's work and so on, I think he was, in a way, afraid of oblivion as a poet. I mean, I think he wanted to keep his name up there. But that, in a way, can come over as someone who is very self-aware, see what I mean? I mean, he was very conscious that he was a particular poet. He knew who he was. And I think he was quite thin about that.
Poetry was a sacred thing to Siegfried.
Yeah.
Yes.
It was a responsibility.
Yes. He was the instrument.
As you so ably...
Yeah. He was the instrument. Yeah.
Yes.
Mm. But that can come over in that, if that's other way. But, I must say, I find that he was someone who really was concerned about his reputation should be there. You know, he found it very difficult when people really got quite uppity with him, and the critics.
Yeah.
And he didn't take criticism kindly at all.
I wonder if any artist in words enjoys criticism. I mean, they are writing with their hearts blood.
I think, but I think there's a difference between not enjoying criticism, because none of us enjoy criticism, but I mean, some of the critics that were writing about you were very distinguished critics. I mean, there were people who had a story about, but he just seemed to, you know, as I said, I loved it because he just talks about the unintellectual moderns. I mean, he didn't particularly like T.S. Eliot because he was all...
I was just going to say, you know, T.S. Eliot was red rag to a bull.
Yeah, because he wasn't direct utterance guy,
yes,
was he?
Exactly.
No. So Siegfried had his kind of, here I am, I know who I am, and I know what I can do, and everybody else, I'm not really, thank you, that's interesting, your opinion. Which Cantor was rather haughty. Always the way I'm expressing it.
Yes, but he always admired those poets who he felt were sympathetic.
Yes, yes, yeah.